Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very well.
You know what we're going to talk about?
What are we going to talk about?
Cocaine.
Oh, don't sing Jackson Brown.
Running all around.
Very old.
Very old.
There it is. Very old.
If you keep talking over me, I'm going to sing it until you stop. We're going to talk about cocaine. I know it's a restaurant show on food and wine, but some genius has come up with an energy drink.
I like to say he's very genius.
Has come up with an energy drink that he named, well, cocaine. And then he put it out on the stores, on the markets. And so you could walk into stores recently and get yourself a bottle of
cocaine.
Not surprisingly, the FDA had a little problem with this.
I think it was on shelves for about 7 minutes.
And they sent him a letter, and the letter said, stop, stop, stop it, you idiot, stop.
Your can can't say cocaine. False advertising, if nothing else. If that's the only reason.
The FDA issued a warning letter last month that said that Redux, which is the company that makes it, is illegally marketing the drink as a street drug alternative and dietary supplement. The FDA cited as evidence the drink's labeling, which includes statements like cocaine.
That's in quotes, by the way.
No, more and more.
Quotations.
It also says in a smaller print, speed in a can, liquid cocaine, and cocaine dash instant rush. Yeah, you can't sell that. See,
can, but you got to sell it like this. Psst, hey,
exactly, and then you get arrested.
Come over here.
Well, and then you can't sell that because it doesn't have any cocaine in it. Users of the drink, first of all, the guy who marketed it said it's meant to be a joke. It's meant to be tongue-in-cheek. Nobody really thinks it has cocaine in it, but yeah, you still can't do it. You can't label it wrong. Users of the drink responded to the announcement by leaving dozens of messages, many of them profanity-laced, on a page credited for the product on the social networking MySpace.com. So let me get this straight. You're going to tell me that the people who were the avid customers of cocaine were the kind of folks who would lose it and leave profanity-laced messages on message boards.
I can't believe that.
I get that.
Seems
okay.
Shocking. Wait, my favorite quote of the whole
thing.
Grow
up, you freaks.
Favorite quote in the whole thing in the Associated Press article that came out. The owner says, of course we intended for cocaine energy to be a legal alternative, the same way celibacy is a legal alternative for premarital sex.
Yeah, but you don't call celibacy premarital sex. The alternative to cocaine is not doing cocaine.
It's not cocaine, right, exactly.
Have a Coke. Have a Coca-Cola. No, but if they successfully challenge this, Mark and I will be launching our own line of beverages. One will be and food supplements. One will be some pills that you can take, vitamin supplements. Well, we're going to call them methamphetamines. And that's going to be the – and we're going to have ecstasy, and we're going to have cigarettes.
Ecstasy, we'll call it.
Right. We'll have cigarettes, and we'll call our brand of tobacco cigarettes marijuana. Stupid. Okay? You know what I wrote down initially in my notes? I wrote, we'll call the brand of tobacco cigarettes Mary Jane. Now, some of our listeners might remember when marijuana was referred to as Mary Jane, but
– but most don't.
Yeah.
So
– I'm old. What can I say? Okay. So cocaine off the shelves was briefly legal in this country, but now off the shelves. On to the next
– it was never legal.
The non-cocaine –
that's what I'm saying.
Cocaine.
It's
no, it was legal. But you can market it until the FDA tells you to pull it off. But now they've said
– which, like I said, was about 7 minutes.
Right. On the legal-illegal drink front, guess what's legal again in the United States for the first time since before Prohibition?
Walking your dog and not cleaning up after it.
Absinthe.
Oh.
That's been legal. That's only legal in the 70s. Absinthe is legal again. Ted Brew, who's been on this show, who's the world's foremost expert on absinthe, has developed for Lucid, an American company, illegal, genuine American absinthe. Now, why absinthe was made illegal was there was a bunch of trumped-up charges on what one of the components that came from one of the botanicals used to make absinthe called...
And this is back in the teens, this is, yeah. You know, 1912, something like that.
Well, one of the substances there called thujone was thought to be a hallucinogen. Well, thujone is a hallucinogen, but you'd have to drink like 9 bottles of absinthe to get... to hallucinate from it. But nonetheless, they didn't know this back then.
Which, since you'd be unconscious, it would be impossible.
Because 9 bottles of liquor you can't drink. So that became illegal, and now it's been legal in Europe for years. It's been legal around the rest of the world. What Ted Brew did was he developed a type of absinthe that has almost no thujone in it by changing the botanical slightly. But there are... It's an anise-based liqueur. Like Pernod is an absinthe replacer, and Pastis is an absinthe replacer. We have a wonderful Pastis in the bar.
And almost every culture has an anise-based liqueur to it, whether it's arak if you're Lebanese, or sambuca if you're Italian, or anisette if you're French.
But they all stem from all absinthe replacers. Well, what Ted did was he found these antique bottles of absinthe. He's a chemist by trade, and he chemically analyzed with a spectrometer exactly what was in these old bottles of absinthe, these pre-prohibition bottles.
It really was fascinating. He took the total chemistry line to figure out what was in these.
Well, to figure out what was in it. And then he took years to figure out how you would achieve that chemical component. So you have a guy who's tasted probably more absinthe than anyone in the world who has worked with this American company called Lucid, which has now made an American absinthe that has little enough thujone to get approval from the BATF. And so it'll be available starting next month, and you can get some at Catherine Lombardi, because I can't wait. I'm all a titter.
Which is amazing, and I don't have any
Twitter?
Actual...
Titter or Twitter? Is it a titter or a Twitter?
I don't know.
All right. Anyway, so you were saying?
It's a Twitter bug, but I think it's a titter.
Okay.
No, I was saying it is amazing that probably, you know, and I don't know the actual facts here, but it's legal to have less thujone than it is to have, you know, other carcinogenic things in our food, you know, like arsenic and things like that in our food.
Well, it's funny because the European government...
You know, certain amounts of arsenic are legal to be in your food.
Yeah, well, European governments a long time ago realized that the thujone... Well, you know, we basically just analyzed it and realized that the thujone wasn't that big a problem, was not really a hallucinogen, or could not be a hallucinogen in the amounts you find it in absinthe. But the problem is we have a very puritanical culture in America, and no legislature wants to get on the repeal the absinthe ban legislation. No one's
right,
going to be a sponsor.
Right, there's no good that you can't win yourself points by being on the
get crucified because in our 30-second media culture, you know, someone can say, you know, this politician is for bringing evil liquors back, you know, making more liquors legal. Yeah, you want to be that guy running for office against Mothers Against Drunk Driving, even though it doesn't make any sense. Anyway, it's the company is called Lucid. It's a new absinthe. It'll be available starting next month. It'll be about $60 a bottle. But again, it's a spirit. It's not a wine. So it's about $60 a bottle. Not cheap, but I think that we've had it in Europe. But if you haven't ever had absinthe, it's cool thing that you might want to try when it comes out next month. Ask your local retailer. We're going to be talking, and just after the next segment, about a less intoxicating subject. We're going to be talking about American beer.
Oh, that's quite intoxicating.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Roger Sherman, who's here to talk about beer. Roger was nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short Subject for his film The Garden of Eden. His newest film is The American Brew, which tells the history of beer in America.
Roger, I love beer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. I'm on my 7th bottle of absinthe. I'm just trying to...
Full thujone absinthe too, I might add. Hey, Roger, so your short film for which you were nominated for an Oscar was The Garden of Eden. Now you've done a documentary on beer. Was there any beer in The Garden of Eden? I've always thought there was.
I'm sure there was. The beer goes back to Sumeria thousands of years ago, and that's the earliest trace of it, but I'm sure it was much older than that. How could anybody live without it?
Well, I remember reading, I'm a dork for food history, and I remember reading in the Middle Ages that beer was so important because it was... And it was often a non...
I was thinking because life stunk and you needed to get drunk.
I understand that in the Middle Ages, the beer was a way to basically clean water. People would take a bucket, and it wasn't carbonated. People would just take a bucket of water and leave it by the hearth where it would be warm, and they throw some grain in there so that it would ferment. And it was basically, I guess, more wort than a beer. But that was a way to clean the water. And I remember Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton, who did many things, including discovering the Nile, used to say of people who traveled in hot climes, he'd say, water drinkers die first. And he always put a little whiskey in his water. Was in the development of American beer, was it important to have clean water? Was that part of the allure of beer?
Actually, it wasn't just the Middle Ages. Even through colonial times and after, we didn't drink water because water could kill you. There were lots of things in there that could make you sick or worse. And beer and cider, but beer mostly, was the everyday drink of the day. And it might sound shocking, but men, women, and children drank beer. Now, it wasn't anything like the beer we have today. It was a very low alcohol. They describe it, historians describe it as the soda pop of the day. But it's what people drank. In fact, on ship crossings, water would go rancid very quickly, and beer was the drink that got people across the ocean.
Well, now... With the beer, how, you know, you said kids drank it. It was what we drank all the time. What kind of percentage alcohol are we talking about?
Oh, it's probably less than 1%. Mm-hmm. They would brew three times. Every housewife knew how to brew beer back then, and they'd send it through three times. So the first was real beer. The second was some intermediate that you would drink. I guess the guys drank, and the third was just a. Everyday beverage,
and that's as compared to your American beers, which range from 3.5 to 5% or so.
American beers of today.
Your average beers of today.
Your average lagers today. Yeah, mm-hmm. Your light lagers, exactly.
So beer was really popular with the founding fathers, and with the settlers, and then was continued to be popular with the founding fathers. Was it seen as a tempered beverage, as less than the alcohol that someone would get from spirits? I remember reading that Thomas Jefferson used to encourage people to drink wine because he thought it was a great answer that would get them to stop drinking whiskey.
All the founding fathers had breweries. Alexander Hamilton wanted to have a national brewery, and they saw that it was better to get a taste for beer than for spirits. And people were paid in beer back in the colonial times, so it was considered a healthy beverage. People, especially poor people, didn't have very good diets, and beer was full of vitamin B, the B complex vitamins, all kinds of things. It was actually called liquid bread,
huh.
And early advertising, right up to Prohibition. Had beer as a healthy beverage.
Sure, if you look at Guinness ads, I mean, that's their whole shtick, is Guinness is good for you.
Right, you can say that again now, that's true.
I had a grandfather who used to put, a great-grandfather who had horses in Ireland, and a grandfather who had horses in the United States, used to work with the horses, they used to put Guinness in the feed of the horses. Made them run faster, so they thought. So, did beer then fall out of fashion? Or did it stay? I know that the beer had a huge, and I want to talk to you about the beer having a huge increase in popularity with the wave of German immigration. But did it sort of fall out of fashion between the founding fathers and the first waves of great German immigration, or did it just stay popular right throughout?
No, it pretty much stayed popular, but the German immigration in the mid-1800s changed not only our taste for beer, but the taste for the whole world. There was a great influx of people going across the country, and the Germans brought their beer with them. They opened beer gardens, which shocked Protestant America, having beer on Sundays. But they wanted to take the day off and have some fun. And they developed these lagers, and then with cold brewing, they were able to develop a different kind of lager beer, which took the world by storm. It just tasted better, and it didn't. By the end of the 19th century, the entire world had switched from ales to drinking lager beers.
We're going to talk about, F, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to talk more with Roger Sherman about what a cold brew beer is and how German immigrants in America changed the way the world drinks beer. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Roger Sherman about his film, The American Brew, which you can find out more about and find out how to get on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Roger, before the break, we were talking about how the German immigrants in the United States started making lager beers, cold-brewed beers, and how that changed the way the world drinks. What is the difference between a cold-brewed beer? What makes a cold-brewed beer cold-brewed, and why is it so different?
Well, very simply, it needs to be brewed under cold temperatures. Ale does not need to be brewed under cold temperatures, and we're talking about well before refrigeration. The Germans came over. They always settled near big rivers or lakes where they could cut the ice out of the rivers or lakes in the wintertime. It would be stored in ice houses. Caves were dug to store the beer. The ice, the air would flow down as cold air flows down into the caves, keeping the beer cold. But they couldn't brew much between October and April. And on a warm winter, you can imagine the mess that happened. In the mid-1850s, refrigeration was invented, and all of a sudden they were able to brew beer anytime they wanted. Interesting little factoid is that for the first 20 years of refrigeration, they basically did exactly the same as they'd done for decades before. They used it to make giant chunks of ice, which they brought into the ice house. Finally, somebody learned how to put a fan in front of the condenser, and modern refrigeration was born.
Well, when these German immigrants came and brought this kind of beer, or started producing this kind of beer in America, was this a kind of beer that had always been brewed in Germany that they just recreated here, or was it a new kind of beer?
It was pretty much a new kind of beer. It changed the beer that they were drinking back home as well. They were innovators, and they took on the American dream, and Americans are entrepreneurial. We've always have been, and they started tinkering, and lager, as we know it, was born.
Now,
what Francis and Roger have just described is really the difference between a lager and an ale, which a lot of people, I think, sometimes are always, you know, you go into the store and you're questioning. It's really how they're brewed, isn't it, Roger?
That's right. And not to get too complicated, it's the difference in the yeast. Ale is top fermented, which simply means that the yeast stays on the top of the tank. And the lagers are bottom fermented. Now, once you open that can of worms, with the sophistication of brewing today, there are lagers that are top fermented. There are ales that, you know, it just, you can go crazy with it. But basically, that's the difference.
But stylistically, it created a taste that had been theretofore unseen, which was that crisp, slightly bitter, very clean taste beer that we now know.
Exactly. Perfect for our hot summers, a nice, clean, cold beer.
Well, I think that one of the things that is fascinating that we can't talk about this subject and not talk about, when we come back after the break, we're going to be talking more with Roger Sherman about Prohibition and how that affected beer and beer sales and the beer culture in this country and how we've recovered since. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today, we're talking about beer, specifically the history of beer in America. Robert Sherman, who was nominated for an Oscar for his best documentary, for his short subject documentary, The Garden of Eden, has come up with a new film called The American Brew, The History of Beer in America. Roger, we were talking before the break about things prior in older history in America. Now I want to turn our attention to the period before Prohibition. Saloons sort of got a bad reputation. They were associated with gambling and prostitution. Was it a deserved reputation?
It was a deserved reputation. And to backtrack 1 second, because you asked about the popularity of beer, between 1860 and 1900, beer consumption in America increased 400%. And at the late 1800s, there was a system called the Tide System, where taverns, pubs, were either owned or licensed by breweries. Breweries were all local at the time. And the tavern owners or licensees were not allowed to sell anything but their own beer. Mm-hmm. And there was something called the 5-cent beer, which long after that was economical, breweries made pub owners sell beer for 5 cents. So what were they to do? Well, they brought in gambling. They brought in prostitution. They brought in all kinds of things to try to supplement their meager incomes.
Subsidies,
as it
were. There
were so many pubs in America. Some towns had a saloon for every 80 people. That includes men, women, and children. So you can imagine the competition was fierce.
So why the 5-cent beer? Why didn't they respond to the market and allow beer to be sold?
And raise the price.
Well, they tried to raise the price, and there were mass protests. There were almost riots broke out across the country. People were not going to pay 10 cents for a glass of beer.
No, they should come to our bar, boy. So then we have the movement for Prohibition gain steam. Take us through Prohibition.
Well, Prohibition actually starts years before with a temperance movement. The venereal disease, the wife battering, the children battering that would come home from only men frequented taverns in those days, gave taverns a very deserved bad name. And the temperance movement started gaining steam. Now, it wasn't just beer. In fact, the brewers tried to distinguish themselves from the hard spirits by saying the beer is not something you get intoxicated on. In fact, in the 1800s, there were numerous lawsuits. People would get arrested, and the defense a number of times was that we're drinking beer, it's not intoxicating, and in fact, those people were found not guilty. It didn't help that much because...
You think that might work in, like, North Brunswick on a DUI if somebody got one of those?
Not anymore. Not with the alcohol content of beer. I think we're drinking a few more beers than they did back then. But before Prohibition actually was enacted, you know, Prohibition was from 1920 to 1933. By 1919, 33 states had already prohibited or limited the sale of alcohol. So prohibition was just the final nail in the coffin. It was years of protests. Carrie Nation, for example, is a sort of whack job, but a very effective whack job, who would go in with other people with hatchets, and they called it hatchetation, and they would whack apart a bar and ask the people there for forgiveness, to get down on their hands and knees and pray to God that they could kick the habit. And she got a lot of publicity, but it worked pretty well.
Well, and that was the advent of bouncers. When they saw Carrie Nation coming, they have bouncers outside the tavern. All right, no, maybe not. When Prohibition finally came, there were some breweries that survived, some businesses that were breweries that survived. How did they survive?
How's a brewery survive Prohibition?
Yeah, they survived by going into other businesses. The most common was to make soft drinks. There was Bevo beer that Budweiser made, that Anheuser-Busch made. There was ice cream. Yingling made a very, very good ice cream. It seemed that the processes, the sterilization, the steel tanks, all of that lent themselves to these other businesses. But they survived, but barely.
Right. Yeah, they didn't thrive.
It was not a good business.
I've sold ice cream. I've sold beer. It's hard to survive on the ice cream.
It's much harder to survive on the ice cream. You know, at the start of Prohibition, in the 1870s, there were 3,200 breweries. At the end of Prohibition, there were 185.
Hmm.
And once you closed your doors, it was just almost impossible to open them again. However, there were breweries brewing beer all across America all through Prohibition, and it was because organized crime were able to pay off the police and other public servants to look the other way. And as Dan Okrent, who's a historian, says in the film, there was obviously organized crime before Prohibition, but they really got it together during Prohibition. So you'd have major breweries that were brewing right in daylight to the public, they kept going all through Prohibition. So people really could continue to get their beer. They could continue to get the hard stuff, but beer suffered worse because it was much easier. You could put a couple of cases of hard stuff in the back of a car, and really you'd move a lot of goods. Beer was much heavier, much bulkier, and it was too risky and too expensive. You know, you could, you know, for a buck or two, you could buy a fifth of gin and have a whole party, whereas beer couldn't compete with that.
Some would say that wine industry survived very much the same way. Tongue in cheek, of course, that wine industry, some winery stayed open selling sacramental wine to the church. So,
yeah.
You know, their own kind of tongue in cheek, I'll say, their own kind of organized crime, as
very
it were.
Very religious with that, all of a sudden. Hey, so when Prohibition ends, the brewers initially thought it was going to be a panacea, but it didn't turn out. The end of Prohibition didn't turn out to be the panacea that brewers thought it might be. Why?
That's right. A whole generation grew up not drinking any kind of alcohol, especially beer, and many people were just not used to it, and they were not going to. It took in 1980, there were only 48 breweries in America, and you know, so the turnaround took a very, very, very long time.
Yeah, I also remember I saw in your movie, there's the statistic that in 1980 there were 48 breweries. In 1996 there were 1,500 breweries.
2005, but that's right. That's right. And the craft brew revolution and the microbrew revolution is really part of the reason for that. I mean, they're still a very, very small part, 2% of the entire market, but they're floating all boats. They're making interesting beers, and the United States is the most interesting place to both brew and drink beer in America. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself.
In the country, yeah.
Well, we've taken, you know, the culture and the traditions of other countries and kind of made them our own. I mean, there are people brewing Belgian-style ales, and there are people brewing Czech-style ales, and people brewing German-style ales, and all the different kinds of subcultures in those ales in the United States. We kind of have, like most of the things we do, we've taken everything from everybody and tried to kind of incorporate it into our own.
It's very, very American. You know, I, in making films, I am never an expert when I start, and I feel that that's a very good idea, because if you're an expert, you don't know what to include and what not to include. And I can represent an audience that doesn't necessarily know everything there is to know about a subject, in this case, beer. I was a beer drinker. Now I consider myself more an appreciator, but things like the craft brew movement, craft beers, were completely under my radar. I didn't know that, you know, there's a brewery within 10 miles of just about all of us. And even the big guys, even Anheuser-Busch, Coors, Miller, they're also brewing more interesting beers today, going out from their normal. And, you know, you talk about Czech beers and German beers. If you go to that town in Germany, you can drink that incredible beer that's been brewed for 400 years. And not a lot else.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you there's a brewery in America that makes that same beer and 12 other varieties of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're American, we say, gee, that's good, but what if?
Yeah.
You know, let's put this in it. Let's put extra spices in it. Let's put spruce tips in it. Let's do something else. And that's why America is really the place to brew and drink.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Roger Sherman about his film, The American Brew, which you can pick up at our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and read more about him and find out more about beer in general. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1146.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking about Roger Sherman's film, The American Brew, with Roger Sherman. Roger, we've been talking a lot about the history of beer in America, and after Prohibition, we came back with very few breweries and a generation that grew up without a tradition of beer, the same tradition of beer that we'd had prior to Prohibition. Was the beer from the end of Prohibition through to, say, the 70s, where we saw the birth of the craft beer movement, was it much more insipid than it had been? I mean, was the flavor of beer less good than it was prior to Prohibition?
I don't think it was less good, but the bigger breweries were able to take advantage of the hard times. They maybe had a little more money squirreled away. It became a big time for marketing, for consolidation. After Prohibition, a brewery is no longer allowed to own a tavern. That's the distribution system. The distributors came about at that time. And it just took a long time.
I remember when the first microbrew I ever had was made by a gentleman that you featured in your film, Fritz Maytag. It was an Anchor Steam Liberty Ale that I had in 1986. And I remember that my mind exploded. I was like, oh, my God, beer can taste like this? but it was more bitter. It was stronger. It was something that that people weren't used to. And a lot of people initially reacted to these more flavorful beers in a negative way. I mean,
and there are still people who do.
I own
two restaurants with two bars.
Right,
still people who want
an Amstel Light or a Corona,
the least flavorful beer that I can offer.
How was there a lot of consumer resistance to these craft beers, and how did they come about? And talk to us about a guy like maybe Fritz Maytag, who really made a difference.
Well, Fritz was a student at Stanford University, and Maytag, yes, he is of the Maytag family, and he frequented a spaghetti restaurant in San Francisco, and one day the owner said, you know, the Anchor Steam Brewing Company is going out of business. You ought to go and check it out. And he went over there, and as he says in the film, you don't get up in the morning and decide you're going to fall in love, but that's exactly what he did. The owners didn't want to have bad credit on their on their records, and they were about to go out of business, so they sold it to him for a song. And you talk about whether the beer was good or bad. He has a famous story that I guess he tells a lot and tells wonderfully in our film, where he went to try to sell the beer to a German restaurant, and the guy says, "Yeah, I know that beer. It's terrible beer. It's hard to sell bad beer."
Right.
And he figured out, and within a few years, he had one of the most sophisticated, highly technical breweries in America. And who would have known, this is the early 60s, that would be sort of the genesis of craft brewing. Others like him, the Sierra Nevada brewery. Mm-hmm.
That was one of my first. Sierra Nevada, I think, was Sierra Nevada Pale Ale.
Yeah, was a home brewer. And he just said, you know what, I think I'd like to do this. And he
I just want to say, if anybody wants to learn more about the whole Fritz Maytag story, obviously they can listen, see your movie American Brew. Also, they can go to restaurantguysradio.com. About a year and a half ago, we did an interview with Fritz that's up on the web.
That's great.
Was a very informative interview. But go ahead. I'm sorry about
That's okay.
Sierra Nevada.
You know, Ken Grossman, there was no craft brew industry, so there was no supplies. The tanks were gigantic. Nobody, you know, starting out would be able to afford that. And so he scoured Northern California and Oregon and found dairy farms that were going out of business and was able to adapt dairy equipment. He took courses at the local community college in welding and other things. And eventually he found some beer that he liked after doing a lot of test brews and throwing them down the drain. And Sierra Nevada was born. And that's really very typical of the story as craft brews progress. Then in the 70s, you've got the microbrew industry, which is basically brewing on site in your restaurant. That's somewhat differentiates from a craft brewer, but the lines get blurred. And that exploded so much that after a while there were too many of them. They didn't realize how difficult it was. Many didn't realize how difficult it was to brew good beer, and there was a fallout of microbrewers.
But well, the ones who weren't doing it well, I think, fell away. We have a great one in New Brunswick called Harvest Moon that brews their own beers and some really interesting things.
I think one of the interesting things about your film is to talk to those, when you talk to those guys from Sierra Nevada, and they have like the dairy equipment that they purchased and then hybridized and made a Frankenbrewery out of, and it's fascinating to see the ingenuity. I'm afraid, Roger, we need to leave it there. I could probably talk to you all day, but I need to go and have a beer.
Let's go have a beer. Raise a glass.
It's been great to have you on the show. The film is The American Brew. It's a history of beer in America. You can find out how to get it through our website at restaurantguysradio.com, and we suggest that you do. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants.
You know, earlier in the show, we were talking about, you know, the things that can go wrong with your water and why people choose to drink or chose throughout history to drink beer or drink wine or various other spirits. Because the river water might be brackish, or the ocean water, obviously, you couldn't drink for whatever reasons, or, you know, through a long voyage, your water would go rancid. Well, Francis, you're aware that recently I went and had a little flood in my basement.
I recall 9 feet is not a little flood.
Well, we got a little water in the basement. Well, one of the items lost, I had one of those wine units in the basement. And filled with river water. Actually, the river came up so high that it entered my basement, and I was actually part of the river. And so, of course, my initial response, pulling the water out of the basement, then pulling the bottles out of this cooler, which had been filled with river water, sludge, dirt, all sorts of nastiness.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up the bottles. And actually, not that long ago, I had a gentleman who was an environmental biologist. He said, you know what? That river water, even if it did somehow seep through the cork, you're going to have There's really no pathogen that can survive
in the alcohol
of a bottle of a bottle of wine. It's why people drink wine, because it's
healthier.
It killed pathogens.
Right.
You could drink wine or beer, those types of things, those alcohols. Anyway, so Francis and I decided to do a little experiment together, and I grabbed some of those bottles and I said, "All right, let's see what these taste like. We'll take our chances and we'll experiment with this." You want to tell people how that experiment went, Francis?
Well, if anyone would like to know, what is the name of the river that goes through your
town? It is the Rahway River.
It had a certain sense of the Rahway River to it, which I don't know that I'd swim in. Never mind, do I want to put in my wine.
Yeah, so there are a couple.
It was sort of a Rahway River spritzer.
I got to tell you. Actually, there's one word that I could use to describe the wine that was in that cooler.
Gross.
Yeah. I don't know how to spell it, but I definitely can say it.
Yeah, that's right.
We opened a couple of different things.
And the thing was, you keep most of your wine in the restaurant, so the bottles that you had at home, you had some very special bottles of wine.
Yeah, and luckily not that many, but yuck. Ugh.
Yeah, I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry for that.
But, you know, that's another thing. The damage to it wasn't just from the river, from the water in the river. The damage was also from the temperature change, which I found fascinating.
Let's stop talking about that bad wine, and let's go have a beer.
Excellent.
Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.